All right, if you guys have a Bible with you, if you'll open up to 2 Kings chapter 24. We're going to be finishing up our journey through the book of Kings. We're looking at the final stages of the Judean kingdom. If you remember, as we were looking at it last time, there was one great revival that happened just before the end of the kingdom of Judah. It was under the rule of King Josiah, who was going in and doing all of these reforms. He was returning Israel back to serving God as best as he could. Obviously, he couldn't make the people of the land. He couldn't turn their hearts and force them from their hearts to change, but he certainly did his part to try to institute whatever changes that he could. And so we looked at all the extent that went to and all that that he did, basically because he heard the word. You know, the word of the Old Testament law was read to him, and he realized how far Israel had drifted from God's original intention for them, and it put the fear of the Lord in him. He got afraid because he realized that their kingdom was going down. It was on a crash course for judgment. And so he did all that he could, but remember the prophecy had been spoken to him that the words were going to come to pass, and you know the people's hearts hadn't changed, and so it was still going to be judgment, but it wouldn't be in his day. So he passed off the scene, and so we pick up here in 2 Kings chapter 4, and his son has taken over. His son, Jehoiakim, was 25, if you remember that from before. And actually, what happened was his son, that's right, I need to give you a little bit more background. His son was made king and went to, was made king after Josiah died at the hand of the Egyptians. Remember, he went down to attack the Egyptians, and the Egyptians killed him. And because he was killed, then all of a sudden the Egyptians had control. So his son was made a puppet ruler under the Egyptians. And that's where we left off. So they're in a precarious state. Judah was in this position where they were the last boundary between Egypt, who was trying to resist the growing Babylonian empire, and the Babylonians themselves, who are coming, you know, from the east and northeast towards them. And so that's where we kind of pick up our story. And it's there in chapter 24, verse 1. It says, in his days, talking about Jehoiakim's days, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. And then he turned and rebelled against him, and the Lord sent against him raiding bands of Chaldeans, bands of Syrians, bands of Moabites, and bands of the people of Ammon. He sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word that the Lord had, which he had spoken by his servants the prophets. Surely at the commandment of the Lord this came upon Judah, to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he had done. And also because of the innocent blood which he had shed, for he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood which the Lord would not pardon. Okay, so Jehoiakim he started off, when we last saw him, he was a puppet king of Egypt. And now all of a sudden we see that he's a vassal of the Babylonian king. And what happened in the interim there, we know from the historical accounts, is that Egypt had made a preemptive strike against Babylon. They went up to attack Babylon, and it didn't work for them at all. And so as they were running away, as they were being chased by the Babylonians, the Babylonians went way far south and subdued Egypt. And then on their way back north, northeast, back to their own territory, they stopped by and took over Jerusalem. And so that's how all of a sudden we've switched the invaders now. Now it's the Babylonians. So and so it says that after 3 years, he's been a vassal of Babylon for 3 years, and after 3 years, apparently he just had enough. Something, he just snapped and said, I don't want to do this anymore. He reached his breaking point, and so he tries to rebel against Babylon. But unfortunately for him, the text tells us that this was God's work. And when God's trying to teach a lesson, there's just no resisting that. I mean, we can resist all we want, but the Lord's going to teach his lessons. That's just the way that goes. And so this is being orchestrated by something far bigger than himself, and he can't just rebel against it. And so it says, you know, all these bands start invading, and there's nothing worse than having bands invade. You know, they're just the tortured artists and stuff, and whining and going all over the place. It's terrible. And it's innocent, you know, the innocent blood is described as being the core underlying reason for this, something that's to the point where, you know, it's just saying the Lord will not pardon, not meaning that it's some unpardonable sin, but because they hadn't, you know, confessed, they hadn't turned to the Lord for this. This is something that he was still, holding as something, as part, you know, holding up as part of the things that they had committed. Most believe that, to understand this, to be talking about the persecution of the prophets. Remember, we believed that under Manasseh's rule, Isaiah, that's according to rabbinic tradition, Isaiah was killed. He was put inside of a hollow log and sawn in two. And so the persecution against the prophets and those who were seeking to follow the Lord, you know, they ended up being martyred. So, I mean, God cares about the blood of his people. God cares about these types of things. You know, we even see that interesting little vignette in the book of Revelation where under the altar, the souls of those who were slain for the Lord's sake are calling out, asking how long. And that's when the Lord makes an alarming statement, says, hang on there, it's just a little bit, but I will repay. I mean, he says that, I'll repay, vengeance is mine, I'm going to take care of these dudes. So, you know, don't worry about it. But clearly this is something that is important to God. We think about the nations around the world where those who hold fast to the salvation through Jesus Christ are persecuted. Got an alert from Voice of the Martyrs about a pastor who's just been put in jail, asking us to pray for him. And they've got a little CNN thing where you actually see him being arrested. I mean, it's just it's a serious thing. And the nations that do this, I mean, are going to have to answer. They may not answer for it in this day and age, but somewhere along the line, someone's going to answer for this if it's not repented of. All right, verses 5 to 9. It keeps going here then. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, aren't they written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Jehoiakim rested with his fathers. Then Jehoiakim, his son, reigned in his place. And the king of Egypt didn't come out of his land anymore, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. His mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elinathan of Jerusalem, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father had done. So when Jehoiakim died, his son Jehoiakim became king. Obviously, these guys were not extremely creative when it came to names. It was like, well, his name ended with an M. N. You're brilliant. Anyway, and he wasn't a good king either. It says that, that he did evil according to what his father had done. They're all not following in the footsteps of the grandfather, Josiah. So they're following a different path. They're trying to be independent of God. And we see here that the troubles aren't coming from Egypt anymore. Egypt has suffered serious losses too. So now we recognize that Babylon is a growing empire. It's beginning to spread out over the Middle East. And it's the way it always goes through these nations. I mean, you know, a big fish comes along and you get so afraid, but then a bigger fish comes along and eats him, and then a bigger fish eats him. That's just the way this goes. And of course, Judah is still just small fry in all of this. They're just like little minnows in the pond at this point, but so big things are taking place over all the known world at that time. Huge upheavals on the political scene, and you know, it's an unnerving time to be alive for these guys. So verse 10, at that time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came against the city as his servants were besieging it. And then Jehoiakim, king of Judah, his mother, his servants, his princes, and his officers went out to the king of Babylon, and the king of Babylon in the 8th year of his reign took him prisoner. So the previous king, his father, had kind of rebelled against the Babylonian Empire, and it resulted in them sending raids in and causing disruptions. But this revolt now has turned into something more serious. Now all of a sudden we've got the Babylonian, the Chaldean army moving in against Jerusalem. That's a serious sign. I mean, that's not good for them. And all of a sudden they look out one morning and they're just ringed around by soldiers everywhere, all around the city. And it's, you know, this is the might of the Chaldean Empire being focused on the Judean kingdom. This is being focused here on Jerusalem. So this is, you know, this is a bad scene for all of them, and there's really nothing they're going to be able to do about that. I mean, you can't resist something like that on a natural plane. I mean, this is this is not good. So Jehoiakim hopes to appease the king of Babylon by going out and basically surrendering, you know, basically saying, you know, sorry about all of that. You know, sorry we haven't been paying tribute and all of these different things. And he's taken prisoner. It results in him being taken. You know, they just grab him and throw him in a paddy wagon and haul him out of town. And so, you know, it's hard to tell, but you kind of think that maybe it didn't go the way he was hoping it would go, especially since he brought, you know, the whole clan with them. All his kinfolk were there with them too. And they all get carried away. So, you know, you don't ever want to get carried away to Babylon. So then verse 13. And he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and he cut in pieces all the articles of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Lord had said. And he carried into captivity all of Jerusalem, all the captains and the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the poorest of the people of the land. And he carried Jehoiakim captive to Babylon, the king's mother, the king's wives, his officers, and the mighty men of the land. He carried into captivity into Babylon all the valiant men, 7,000, and craftsmen and smiths, 1,000, all who were strong and fit for war. These the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. So, you know, once he's got the king, obviously the city is his. Nebuchadnezzar can go in and do whatever he feels like now. So, you know, his troops start marching in, and you know, we've seen this repeated over and over through history. I mean, the attacking troops march in to the city that they have now taken control of, and they start looting it. They're going to take everything that they want. So they go in and they strip everything out of the house of the Lord and all the you know, it goes through all this, you know, the gold things. And you wonder about that at that point, because, you know, in the temple of the Lord, in the Holy of Holies, is the Ark of the Covenant. It's been there all this time, ever since David brought it back into Jerusalem. And you wonder about that. Is this when they carted the Ark away or whatever? Now, rabbinic tradition says that Jeremiah actually took it and hid it during this period of time, but nobody knew where he hid it. But then there's Ethiopian legends that say that Solomon actually had a son by the Queen of Sheba. And that his son had come up during this period, or the people, the establishment, not his son, but the kingdom that was established under his son, had come up there and taken the ark at that time and secreted it away to Ethiopia, to a little post there, where they say to this day, Smithsonian ran a really interesting article about it, Dale have me read it, where they say to this day the Ark of the Covenant resides. They've got a place, no one's allowed in it, there's a guard there, there are people who say they've seen it, you know, who knows, it's just stuff of legend, it's great for In Search Of or whatever. Is Leonard Nimoy still alive? I don't even know, but either way, you know, it's that kind of stuff. There's absolutely no way to know, you know, any of that. But you wonder about that. It's interesting that this text is not going to tell us about that. There's no mention of that in this part of the text. So either way, you know, they come in and they take all this stuff. And then it also goes through all the people. They take all the military guys out, obviously. They take them out, and the captains, the commanders, and all the men who are fit for war. And it also says the smiths. They didn't take the Joneses, but they took the smiths and the other craftsmen and stuff like that and carted them off. But the idea behind that is that they want all the skilled people. They want everybody who's got a craft, they've got a skill, they've got something to bring to the table that Babylon can make use of, because now they're going to be slaves. And then later on, as we get into the book of Daniel, we'll see how this is all working out. These guys got integrated into the whole Babylonian system of things. So the only people that are going to be left there in Jerusalem are the people who are poor, people who are unskilled, people who are, you know, more than likely, you've got widows, a lot of widows left over, because they had, you know, they were the lowest on the rung there within the strata of that society. You've got elderly people. So all of these people are the ones that are left in what is basically, by and large, for all intents and purposes, an emptied out city. I mean, they're you know, it will get refilled over time, and people will begin to move back into it, and we'll see how that kind of goes down, because there's still this nationalistic sense that's there, and a desire to protect and preserve Jerusalem. But at this point, you know, it's a bad deal all the way around. And I completely forgot where I left off at. I'm over here at verse 17. And then the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, Jehoiakim's uncle, king in his place, and he changed his name to Zedekiah. Now Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libnah. And he also did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For because of the anger of the Lord, this happened in Jerusalem and Judah, He finally cast them out from his presence. Then Yedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Okay, so Jehoiakim's uncle is the one that they left in charge. Basically, they made him a puppet king over the provinces there, over what is basically an empty city. He has no real power or authority. It's all under the governance of Babylon. But the idea was that you're going to have somebody who's loyal to you that's left in that territory there that's going to make sure that anything that's still owed you is going to be coming your way and to manage whatever indigenous population is left. They change his name. You notice how often they're changing names in the Bible? I mean, that goes on all the time. And it's not just to confuse us either, but there's an idea behind that speaks of ownership. Every time that we see a name change take place, it's because of that, because there's a change of allegiance. There's a change of a sense of loyalty that's associated with that. In this case, he's changing his name to a Babylonian name to make sure that he's going to be following his orders and doing what it is that he says to do. But we see that God does this sort of thing. He did that with Peter. Remember, his name is Simon, and Jesus gives him the nickname Peter or Cephas, or basically in our terminology it'd be Rocky. Or he said that with Paul, he was Saul to begin with, and the Lord changed his name to Saul, Paul. And it's confusing. But the idea behind that is a change of allegiance. Every time we see that, that's the concept behind it. And so that's what he's trying to promote here. He's trying to say, this man now belongs to me. I've named him. He's part of my crew. And it's the idea of submission to a master. And it uses this terminology here that could be unsettling when it talks about, the Lord had, was casting them out and all of that. The whole idea that they'd done so much evil, he cast them out from his presence. And we do need to, we kind of understand that we don't want people to get the wrong impression of God from those kinds of statements. But we're not talking about people, when we look at this and we look at the system as it was in place, and we look at the methodical means by which the Israelites departed from the covenant that God had made with them. We're looking at people we're not talking about people that stumble and fall, who want to do the right thing, who make mistakes, because we're all prone to that. I mean, we could look at that and get a little concerned. We could look at that and think, oh man, someday God's just going to get fed up and just cast me away or whatever. And that can, kind of mess with your head. And we don't want to understand God from that kind of perspective. That's not the idea behind this. This is the idea of unrepentant people. People who were absolutely, completely determined to live in independence from God. And so God at one point finally says, all right, this is what you want. You want independence. I will give you independence. I will give you what you desire here. And in that sense, that's the idea. And the idea of casting off isn't in the sense of, I'm sick of you, I'm booting you away, but it's just the idea of, okay, I'll let you go. I'll you want to go adrift, you want to go on your own, I'll give you your desire in this. And of course, that man's ways are always going to lead to that sort of trouble. Now, Jeremiah's account tells us that there were a lot of false prophets that were left there in the empty city of Jerusalem, who were prophesying to Zedekiah that if they were to rebel against the king of Babylon, that they would succeed, that God would give them victory, and they'd be able to drive these guys away, just like in the old days, just like in the other times when the city was besieged before, and the Lord gave victory, to Hezekiah and all these different, people. And different times that the Lord had done that. And Jeremiah, through all of his book, is running around saying, don't listen to these guys. They're not speaking from the Lord. They're not speaking the truth. This is, you got to recognize and realize God is behind this. God's orchestrating this. He's teaching us a lesson. We're going to have to learn this lesson. Don't fall for this kind of stuff. And, and of course, he got put in prison for his message. And Zedekiah rebels anyway, which we see here at the end of chapter 24, which then leads us over to chapter 25, and we'll pick up here in verse 1. It says, now it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and encamped against it, and they built a siege wall against it all around. So the city was besieged until the 11th year of the king of King Zedekiah. By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine had become so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. The city wall had been broken through, and all the men of war fled I want to stop there. I'm sorry. Whoops. Okay. So Zedekiah's rebellion, you know, he's feeling smart. He's being, you know, told to do all this stuff by false prophets who weren't speaking from the Lord, but were, you know, saying what they thought would be kind of a cool idea. And so he begins this rebellion, and all it does is just, you know, stir this giant who comes back and encamps all around him. And this siege now is very heavy-handed. Now, you notice in here, this is the very first time in the book of Kings that we have ever been given the exact date. It goes through and tells us exactly. This is, you know, it was then, and then, and then, at this time, and this time. And they're using the Babylonian calendar as they do this. And you could kind of look at that and think, well, that's kind of curious. Why in the world are they giving an exact date on this whole thing? It was actually very, very important because in Jeremiah chapter 25, as all of these events are unfolding, the Lord tells Jeremiah, the prophet, he says, this exile is going to last for 70 years. And you need to know that. It's only going to last for 70 years. And so it was very important that the writers here, whether they knew that or not, went ahead and inserted the exact date so that by the time you get to the book of Daniel, or the prophet Daniel, as he's examining this and praying about this, he comes across this and realizes, wait, he's counting on his fingers and his toes. He says, 70 years, it's been 70 years. It's time for the Lord to redeem his people. It's time for us to be delivered from captivity. And so how amazing is it that the Lord makes sure that this just gets slipped in here? I mean, it's almost without, you don't even really kind of think about it that much. You're just kind of reading along, and it's the same stuff that we're reading. And here is this exact date that tells us what was going on so that they would know it. Provided, in essence, you realize that this is the very beginning of this time of exile. You could say this time of judgment, this time of correction for the people of Israel. And the moment it starts, a countdown is beginning. A countdown not to the end, but to the beginning. A countdown that points towards the redemption that's going to take place. Very much like what's going on in the church age. I mean, we're living in a time where, you know, the Lord has removed himself physically from our presence to where we're not walking around with him or whatever. I mean, he's moved into a different realm. He's still directing the issues of the church, but we're still strangers in a strange land. We're still people who are living short of what the fullness of our redemption promises. But from the time that Jesus left, from the time that Jesus took off, I mean, a countdown began. We don't know the exact time, exact dates, exact times. Those weren't given to us. That's what Jesus said. I'm not giving you exact times. I'm giving you the Holy Spirit, and which is much better. So we just follow his leading as we go. But from God's perspective, it's a countdown. We're on our way towards the real beginning, towards the end of this whole nightmarish realm and the beginning of the redemption and the fullness of the redemption as God promised it to us. Now, this siege lasts a year and a half, and it results in a famine. And, of course, that's the point of a siege. You know, sieges in the movies are hilarious to me because sieges in the movies take place in a few minutes. You know, the army encircles the city and boom, 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 and everything falls apart and it's all done. But, I mean, sieges took a long time. And that's the point of them. You can't go up against a fortified city and just take down the walls and be done with it. You know, that's why they're fortified cities. And so they had to build a ramp under protection, you know, a ramp to go up that was going to help them scale the wall and get them across there. But in the meantime, they've set up their armies all the way around the city so that nobody gets in and nobody gets out, and you've cut off all the food supplies, and then it just becomes a war of attrition. We're just going to wear these guys down. And it's only a matter of time, you know, before they're going to run out of food and they're going to, you know, be to the point where they're either just going to starve to death or they're going to surrender. And so that's, you know, so it's a successful siege at this point. Verse 4, then the city wall was broken through and all the men of war fled at night by way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden, even though the Chaldeans were still encamped all around against the city. And the king went by way of the plain. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, and they overtook him in the plains of Jericho. All his army was scattered from him. So they took the king and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they pronounced judgment on him. And they killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, put out the eyes of Zedekiah, bound him with bronze fetters, and took him to Babylon. So at this time, you know, the Babylonians have actually breached part of the wall. Maybe, you know, the idea is that their siege wall ramp has worked, and they've gotten over, and the army's beginning to pour in. And it's a big city, so you figure on one side of town, you know, it's getting overrun, whatever resistance is being held up there, they're getting word back to the king, they've breached the wall. It's all over. It's all done. And so he gathers what men he's got around him, and he says, we're just going to make a break for it. That's the only thing we can do. On the cover of night, through a small gate that nobody's really paying attention to, we're going to get out there, and we're just going to scatter. We're going to get as far away from this as we possibly can so that hopefully we can mount a counterattack some other time. And so it doesn't explain how they do it, but they somehow get through the siege lines, and he gets all the way out to the plains of Jericho. That's a long way. I mean, considering, you know, the transportation and everything, you know, you could almost think, maybe he's thinking, man, I'm almost there. I can almost do it. I can get out of here. I can make it. But it says that the Chaldean army pursues him and actually catches him there in the plains of Jericho. And how ironic is that? That on the plains of Jericho, the place where the Israelites first stepped foot into the promised land by God's promise, is where everything falls apart, where Zedekiah is captured by the Babylonians and is dragged away, and it's emblematic of everything that's going to happen from this point on in the kingdom there. You know, they do this terrible thing. They kill his sons before his eyes. They blind him. You know, you look at history, and there is one constant all the way through history that never seems to change, ever. I suppose will never change until the Prince of Peace returns, and that is man's ability to be inhumane to another human being. The cruelty that is evident all through history. And, you know, we could say, oh, yeah, well, that's back in those days when everything was awful. But, I mean, it still exists to this day. There's still terrible cruelties perpetuated by all kinds of governments and all kinds of different, it doesn't even have to be by governments. Just man's capacity to be cruel to another human being is just one of those constants all through history, and we see it perpetuated here in this story. Verse 8, and in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. And at this point, you have to think, dun, 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 dun. In verse 9, he burned the house of the Lord and the king's house, all the houses of Jerusalem. That is, all the houses of the great he burned with fire. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with him, or were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls of Jerusalem all around. And so this guy's name is probably a euphemism, because it literally means murderer or destroyer. And so he comes in. He's the captain of the guard. He looks around and says, okay, we're gonna deal with this, and we're going to take out this threat once and for all. And so they begin this process of methodically destroying Jerusalem. He begins with the temple, and he destroys the temple, tears it down to the ground. And, you know, Jewish tradition says that it burned for 4 days. And so what he did there was he eliminated the spiritual identity of the Jewish people, with the idea behind that. I'm going to take their temple down to show them that their God didn't save them. And then he breaks down the walls of Jerusalem, which is a huge feat in and of itself. That's a big task that he undertook there. But they broke down the walls, eliminating then the physical security of the Jewish people. They take away their religious identity, remove from them their sense of nationalism or pride of heritage, remove that sense of security from them, that they're not going to have that anymore. And so this would cause any of the population that did remain. It says that he burned the houses of the great people, all the nobles there. They got their houses torched, but you figure there's still a lot of houses left. But the people that are living in that area are going to have to begin the process of trying to fortify to whatever degree they can, and a lot of people are just going to end up leaving. They're not going to hang around in the ruins of a place like that. And, you know, it's only fit for, apocalyptic marauders on motorcycles and stuff coming through the place. And it's just, it's a mess. And so this destruction of Jerusalem, it's an interesting thing, because it doesn't occur just in the heat of a battle. You know, it doesn't happen just because the fight's going on and a lamp breaks or something like that. It's not like that at all. These guys go in and do this intentionally, and it takes time. Obviously, it took time to accomplish this complete and total obliteration of these people and their heritage. And I just think that the fact that their purpose was to annihilate the Jewish people, their purpose was to eradicate the Jewish people from the face of the earth. That was their idea. They were going to bring them over into Babylon. They were going to be absorbed into the Babylonian ways and culture, and that would be the end of them. The alarming thing about that is that it does not succeed. And that's just crazy that it didn't succeed way back then. But it's even more crazy that this whole thing gets repeated again in 70 AD and still doesn't succeed. The Jewish people are still alive today, still hold strongly to their heritage, still believe in their God as they understand him at this time. And that is just amazing to me. To me, that's one of the greatest evidences of God and his work in this earth that you'll ever see, because you just don't see that happening with people. When you've destroyed them to that degree, you just don't see them coming back like that and remaining and thriving even to this very day. So I just find that a remarkable evidence of an invisible God at work. Verse 11. It says, then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive the rest of the people who remained in the city, and the defectors who had deserted to the king of Babylon with the rest of the multitude. But the captain of the guard left some of the poor in the land as vine dressers and farmers. The bronze pillars that were in the house of the Lord, the carts and the bronze sea that were at the house of the Lord, in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke in pieces and carried their bronze to Babylon. They also took away the pots, the shovels, the trimmers, the spoons, and all the bronze utensils which the priests ministered. Now it's starting to sound like Dr. Seuss, isn't it? But anyway, and the fire pans and pazuzels and wazuzels and the basins and the things of solid gold and the solid silver, anything shiny, the captain of the guard took away. The two pillars, one sea, and the carts which Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the bronze of all these articles was beyond measure. The height of one pillar was 18 cubits, and cubits, not cupids, cubits, and the capital on it was a bronze, mental image, sorry. And the height of the capital was 3 cubits, and the network and the pomegranates all around the capital were all of bronze, and the second pillar was the same with a network. The idea of the filigree that was around it and everything that was there. And so, you know, this is the final stage of the captivity. They're taking the remaining people, all except the poorest of the poor, who are going to be left behind basically as migrant farm workers. They're going to work the land and then, of course, send all the proceeds back to Babylon. And after the remaining people are taken away, the final valuables of the temple are taken down and exported out to Babylon. So verse 18, and the captain of the guard took Seriah, the chief priest, Zephaniah, the second priest, and the 3 doorkeepers. He also took out of the city an officer who had charge of the men of war, 5 men of the king's close associates who were found in the city, the chief recruiting officer of the army, yeah, I got to get that recruiting officer out of there, who mustered the people of the land, and 60 men of the people of the land who were found in the city. So Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, took these and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and the king of Babylon struck them and put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamath. Thus Judah was carried away captive from its own land. Seruiah the high priest and Zephaniah, who was next in line, as well as these other guards military men and other men of note, are all rounded up. Now, the way that this is described in here, they were they're from in various places around the city. The idea is they went through and started sifting through every little rat hole that they could find, looking for anybody who was left, anybody who would have still posed a threat against the Babylonian Empire. I mean, a handful of men, what are they going to be able to do? But they were so intent on eradicating Jerusalem as any kind of threat or resistance to their empire, that they went through, sifted through, got this handful of men, and even when they took them out, holy men, priests, put them to death, got rid of them. And so that verse 21, you look at that, and Judah's carried away captive to Babylon. So roughly 850 years after Israel came into the promised land by God's hand, we see that by God's hand, Israel is swept out of the promised land as well, because they wouldn't hold to the covenant. They wouldn't continue believing on him. They determined that they wanted independence, and this is what independence brought them, the determination to find their own way apart from God led them to this kind of desolation. Verse 22, then he, talking about the king of Babylon, made Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, governor over all the people who remained in the land of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had left. Now, when all the captains of the armies, they and their men, heard that the king of Babylon had made Gedaliah governor, they came to Gedaliah at Mizpah, And it lists all these guys who came, whose names I really don't want to have to try to pronounce. They and all their men. So a big gang of guys, a mob, comes to talk to him. And Gedaliah, verse 24, took an oath before them and their men and said to them, "Don't be afraid of the servants of the Chaldeans. Dwell in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and it shall be well with you." Now we know from Jeremiah's accounts that Gedaliah was actually a godly man. And we believe that he was friends with Jeremiah, the prophet. Josephus said that he was a kind and generous man, which oftentimes put him in a position where he was being taken advantage of by his enemies, which is exactly what we see here. He's a good guy. He's a godly guy. He's wanting to do what's best for everybody. And so his course of action is to go ahead and just comply, just do what they tell us to do. We're going to put in our time. We're going to do what it is that, you know, they're asking. We're going to make the best of this, and it'll be well with us. The idea behind that, I believe, from his perspective, is when the time's over, we'll be back. The Lord will deliver us, and it'll be all right. But the guys of the noble families and all, they don't go for that. For them, they think, well, this is traitors. We don't want to do that. They're gathering around saying, what are we going to do? How are we going to get back at these guys? How are we going to start the rebuilding program? And he's saying, no, we're just going to comply. We're going to go along with this until the Lord, you know, delivers us. And so, you know, I just think there's a lesson in this, because this is something that got repeated by the prophets. You know, the Lord is teaching Israel a lesson in this. Now, he's not destroying them in that sense. He's not wiping them off of the face of the earth. We've already said they're here to this day. But there was something in this. The Lord's corrective hand was at work in this. And, you know, sometimes we get into jams and there's no way out, and we look at the situation and, you know, I think that there's something to be learned in just trusting that the Lord's timing is going to be the Lord's timing. He's going to work things out, and not running around trying to fix situations or fix people or anything like that, but just making the best of the situation as we can, trusting that the Lord's in control and that he's going to help and he's going to deliver in his time, rather than doing what these other guys are doing, just figuring out, you know, how. Every time we see this in the biblical record, when guys are sitting around saying, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to deal with this? How are we going to fix this situation? It usually ends up badly. And you know, this will be no exception. This is, you know, and how many times in our own experiences have we determined that we're just going to take matters into our own hands and try to fix everything and fix all of our, you know, friends and associates and loved ones and do all of that ourselves, and found ourselves in terrible messes that are sometimes far worse than what it was before, had we just settled down, made the best of it as we could, and trusted that the Lord, in the bigger picture, was gonna work things out according to his will, according to what was going to be best for us, because that's what he's all about. So verse 25, and it happened in the seventh month that Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Elishama, of the royal family, came with 10 men and struck and killed Gedaliah, the Jews, as well as the Chaldeans who were with them at Mizpah. And all the people, small and great, and the captains of the armies rose and went to Egypt, for they were afraid of the Chaldeans. And so by giving good advice that they didn't like, they go ahead and kill him. You know, obviously for supposedly being a traitor, for being weak and afraid to stand up to the Chaldeans. And then right on the heels of that, they turn tail and run to Egypt, because there's nothing they can do anyway. We couldn't, you know, resist the Egyptians, but we didn't like it that he didn't resist them, or resist the Chaldeans anyway. So they head on out. You know, the whole concept there, you who judge another are guilty of doing the same things. I mean, we're so quick to tear somebody else down for something that we don't like that they're doing, and then we turn around and are basically doing the same thing, but just a different way. And that's certainly what's happened there. So it's a wise idea not to become the judge of our brother or sister, because we're just clearly not good at it. Verse 27. Now it came to pass in the 37th year of the captivity of Jehoiakim, remember him, the guy with the N last name, king of Judah, in the 12th month of the 27th day of the month, that Avil Merodach. Now it looks like evil Merodach or evil Merodach, but it's actually his name, Avil. It's not evil. King of Babylon, in the year that he began to reign, released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison. And he spoke kindly to him, and he gave him a more prominent seat than those of the kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiakim changed from his prison garments, and he ate bread regularly before the king all the days of his life. And as for his provisions, there was a regular ration given to him by the king, a portion for each day, all the days of his life. Well, you know, this is this first king who first did the rebellion, who went out there and was trying to appease the king of Babylon and ended up getting arrested and hauled back to Babylon. So he's been there all this time. And so probably near the end of his days, the king of Babylon, the successing king after Nebuchadnezzar, releases him and obviously strikes up some sort of friendship, something about him he likes. Maybe he's funny or something, or maybe he's nuts from being in prison all this time. Who knows? But for whatever reason, he seems to enjoy him and all of a sudden treats him kindly. Now, what this is and why this is cool, the way Kings ends this way, is that it leaves us with this note of hope. It leaves us with this promise of a future redemption, because what this is showing us is the seeds, is the growing change of season that's there in Babylon, so that it will come to a point in time when, after the kingdoms change hands, that the Israelites are going to be able to return back to their own land. It's a promise of a good future to come. It's a wonderful, it could have been such a dire ending to this book, I guess. You look at that and you think, oh man, everything fell apart for these guys. It didn't work for them. They're crushed. Everything's destroyed and they're carried away and stuff. And yet, in this book, it ends with this strange little vignette of a king who's released, and he changes off his prison garments and is provided for by this foreign king. You just look at this, that it's this picture of blessing, of God's blessing, in the midst even of this desolation, that it may seem like a small thing, but in light of the everything else that's been happening, what a wonderful thing. Amount of hope that's provided in that is just a forecast of a greater hope that's coming. And that's a wonderful thing to remember, and that no matter what our situations are, no matter what's going on in our lives, no matter what we may be facing, we need to keep our eyes open, our ears open for those moments of hope that the Lord provides for us. So those blessings that do emerge, however small, however seemingly insignificant they may be, because those things are a forecast of a greater blessing to come, of a greater deliverance, of a redemption that's sure and irrevocable that comes to us from a Father who loves us. So it's a cool way to end the book as far as I'm concerned, even in the midst of judgment. And so that's the end of Kings. So Father, we just thank you for everything that we've learned from the book of Kings, from 1 Kings and 2 Kings. We thank you for David's story. We thank you for the stories of all the other kings who came after him, the good ones and the bad ones, and all the ways that we can learn from them, the examples that they leave us, and their story that's woven together that reveals you in the process and helps us understand who we are. So I just pray, Father, that we take the lessons from this book, we apply them to our lives, just to allow us to grow and lead us on from here as we journey through your word. And we pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.